Sweet in the morning, oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning.
Hello, my name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. And I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call. Today's wake-up call was prepared on the eve of an historic election in the state of Alabama between Doug Jones, a Democrat, and Roy Moore, a Republican and accused child molester. It appears that Doug Jones has won the election and will be the next senator from the state of Alabama. Now we'll have to wait and see how Alabama's power structure responds to this defeat. In the meantime, the Republican Party's strategy for extracting money from the poor to give to the rich continues apace. Given all of the draconian policies, both domestic and international, coming out of the Trump administration, the nation finds itself in uncharted waters without a sextant or a star to follow. And this is just 1 year of a four-year voyage. Today on Wake Up Call, we'll look at the implications of some of the Trump administration's domestic and international policies. Once again, you're listening to Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and this is a wake-up call. Stay tuned.
Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning,
sweet in the morning.
Following Doug Jones winning the Senate seat in Alabama, Donald Trump couldn't contain himself. And so he took to Twitter, got rid of his staffers for at least a couple minutes so he could go ahead and mouth off and talk about how he's been right all along. Even though he hasn't been right at any moment of this election, including the primaries. So this was the second tweet that Trump put out following the results of the Alabama Senate election. So let's take a look at graphic 12. He wrote the following. The reason I originally endorsed Luther Strange and his numbers went up mightily is that I said Roy Moore will not be able to win the general election. I was right. Roy worked hard. But the deck was stacked against him.
Okay. That God, he's unreal. He's unreal. So not, what do you mean you were right? You went right next to Alabama, held a rally, told everybody to vote for Roy Moore. You said literally, quote, get out and vote for Roy Moore. You recorded a robocall to tell people to vote for Roy Moore. What do you mean you were right? In fact, you were wrong. Twice, not once, but twice. You said you told people in the Republican primary, vote for Luther Strange. And they didn't. They didn't listen to you. You know how he said there, oh, it made a big difference? Actually, I have the polling. And the polling shows it made no difference at all.
I have the exact numbers because I looked into it. I was curious to see if Trump's support for specifically Luther Strange made any difference, right? And here's what happened. Because in that tweet, he said, I supported Luther Strange and his numbers went up mightily. Not true, okay? A poll released one day before the primary runoff in September showed more leading Strange by 11 points. The survey was conducted after Trump appeared at a rally to campaign alongside Strange. And after he had made that appearance, you're right, Cenk, absolutely no difference in the polling regarding Roy Moore and Luther Strange. I mean, this guy is such a clown. So during the primaries, supported Luther Strange. Obviously, Luther Strange lost. Roy Moore won. That's when Trump started backing Roy Moore, and he did so rather aggressively, and obviously, Roy Moore lost. He can't handle the fact that he's a loser, right? He has such thin skin, he couldn't help himself. The original tweet that was put out by Trump's Twitter account, and certainly was not written by him, but that's just my speculation, said the following. Congratulations to Doug Jones on a hard-fought victory.
There's no way he wrote that.
He didn't write this.
There's no way.
There aren't random capitalizations throughout this tweet. The write-in votes played a very big factor, but a win is a win. The people of Alabama are great, and the Republicans will have another shot at this seat in a very short period of time. It never ends.
They added the exclamation point to pretend like it was actually Trump. Come on, who are you kidding? Okay, we know when it's the official guy writing the tweet, and we know when it's Trump. Okay, right. Then his bitter man, I was right all along, was actually Trump. That's right. Obvious, right? So look, on that, one more stat on the whether his support of Luther Strange made a difference. 31% said that Trump backing Strange would make it more likely they would vote for him. 29.5% said it would make it less likely. Okay, 31, 29.5. And then 37% said it makes no difference at all. So nothing, no difference. So, and as we know, of course, Roy Moore easily beat Luther Strange. Mm-hmm. So he not only lost, he lost twice in one election. I don't know if he's getting tired of losing. I know that, you know what, Trump at the end, he was right about one thing. I'm starting to get tired of winning. I mean, if I had told you, and I know that it's a unique situation with Roy Moore being particularly monstrous, but if I had told you when Trump comes in that the Republican Party is going to be in such miserable shape that whoever Trump backs will lose in Alabama, mm-hmm. and we'll lose twice in Alabama, mm-hmm. and we'll have a Democratic senator coming out of Alabama before 1 year is up in Trump's presidency, no one would have believed that. They would have said as they office, you're crazy. Not in Alabama. That's never going to happen. But he found a way to lose. What did I tell you? I did a segment before the election, Loser Donald. I did 100 of them because I know this guy. He's a loser through and through. The only reason he won once in his life, and it was a monumental win. Of course, I grant you that, right? But it's because he ran against the establishment, he ran against the elites, he ran against the worst, most unpopular candidate there was. That was the exception, not the rule. The rule is Donald Trump will always find a way to lose. And even in the presidency, well, but Jake, you won the presidency. He's not even going to make it the whole way. He's going to find a way to turn that win into a monumental historic loss. He's going to implode the Republican Party, as I told you from day one, and then leave the White House in utter shame so that his victory will turn into an epic, historic debacle. You just watched a video by the Young Turks, home of the revolution.
You know, I really want to thank you for coming tonight and realize when the vote is this close that it's not over. And we still got to go by the rules about this recount provision. And the Secretary of State has explained it to us, and we're expecting that the press will go up there and talk to them to find out what the situation is. But we also know that God is always in control. You know, part of the thing, part of the problem with this campaign is we've been painted in an unfavorable and unfaithful light. We've been put in a hole, if you will, and it reminds me of a passage in Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. That's what we've got to do. And he inclined to me and heard my cry and brought us up also out of a horrible pit, out of miry clay, and set my feet on the rock and established my goings and put a new song in our mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and hear it and shall be moved by that, if you will. And that's what we've got to do, is wait on God and let this process play out. I know it's late. We can't wait and have everybody wait till after 11 o'clock. But the votes are still coming in, and we're looking at that. May God bless you as you go on. May he give you a safe journey. And thank you for coming tonight. It's not over, and it's going to take some time. Thank you. Yeah.
When you really love someone, give it up. So hard to do. When you still depend upon her warm and tender touch, her kiss and her caress. That I've tried, but it just ain't no use. But my light of hope is burning dim. But in my heart I pray, yeah.
So Donald Trump is upset at Kirsten Gillibrand because she's a United States senator that suggested that he should resign for all of the transgressions he has had against women. We fully support that. We were one of the folks that started that movement. I'll tell you about a petition in a minute. But of course, Trump was furious about that. And when he tweets about it, you know he's not going to say things that are civil, but this one might have really taken the cake. So he said, lightweight Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a total flunky for Chuck Schumer, and someone who would come to my office, quote, begging for campaign contributions not so long ago, and would do anything for them, is now in the ring fighting against Trump. Very disloyal to Bill and crooked. Used! Exclamation point. The man has no bottom to that barrel, no moral compass at all. Look, you can say lightweight, that's the normal thing that he does. I mean, if Obama had called any Republican senator a lightweight in this childish way, it would have been the biggest scandal in his career. But we've now gotten completely used to Donald Trump being a buffoon man-child. So that's not the issue. Flunky for Chuck Schumer, not sure what he means by that, but we're going in a bad direction. Begging me for donations. Okay, but look, I don't like the donors, and I don't like that they have to go and beg Donald Trump or ask Donald Trump for anything. But you know what he's saying when he says, and would do anything for them. To say that to a female senator, you really are a piece of crap. And it's the same thing when he said about Megyn Kelly. Oh, she was bleeding from wherever. And then say, oh, golly gee, what did you mean? I think you meant, get your mind out of the gutter. By the way, they're going to come back to that excuse in a minute. Okay, so Gillibrand responds by saying, you cannot silence me or the millions of women who have gotten off the sidelines to speak out about the unfitness and shame you have brought to the Oval Office. Remember when the Republicans used to talk about how, oh, Bill Clinton has defiled the Oval Office. Are you kidding me? Trump defiles it on a daily basis. So we started a petition a little while ago, tytnetwork.com/resign. Now that Al Franken has resigned for far less transgressions against women, it is obvious that we should hold people to the same standards. So Donald Trump should also resign for far worse transgressions against women. And if that's the standard we're using, he should. Look, we know that he's not going to listen to any outside forces. But if we get more and more pressure, it can actually start to result in action being taken. So I want to tell you what that action is. On Monday night, a group of more than 50 female House Democrats wrote a letter to the House Oversight Committee to demand a congressional probe, CNN reported. So you actually can do a congressional probe. The Oversight Committee can do one of members in Congress, but they could also do one of the executive branch. So there we go. You get a lot of people to sign that petition, or in any way that you want to participate and put pressure on. Well, and we'll always have the petition, by the way, as a link down below in the description box on YouTube and the comment section on Facebook. Well, all of a sudden, maybe there might be an oversight committee hearing on it, and then we would actually get to hear out the women who are charging with this. By the way, you'd also get to hear the president out, and as all those congresswomen say, well, we want him to present a defense. We believe in due process, right? Well, these comments that were outrageous by Trump, of course, made a lot of people angry in the media, understandably so. Before I get to Sarah Huckabee Sanders' pathetic excuse, let me show you Mika Brzezinski from this morning.
I just want to say something beyond the fact that is reprehensible that the president of the United States would say something so derogatory and disgusting about a woman. We're not surprised, Mr. President. You do it all the time. You treat women terribly, and you treat the women around you even worse. And you treat women like punching bags because it's fun for you, because you are intimidated by women. That's your problem. But for the people who work for you, you need to act. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, good luck today in the briefing. Don't lie and do not defend the President of the United States for what he did.
He is suggesting that Kirsten Gillibrand would do anything.
Let's just say it. He's suggesting that Kirsten Gillibrand would have sex with him in order to get campaign contributions.
Right.
The president actually tweeted that this morning.
He really is a pig, man. He's a disgusting, disgusting guy. You know, if you're a Republican and you like the tweet, why did you like the tweet? You're snickering because you know that that's what he implied. Don't pretend otherwise. Now, speaking of Republicans, Elise Jordan used to work for George W. Bush, worked for Rand Paul. She was also on the program, and she also was not entertained. She thought it was vile. Here she is.
It makes my blood boil. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand might be on the other side of the political aisle. She is a class act. She's a brilliant woman. She's had a great career. She's an inspiration. And he is trying to silence her by insinuating that parentheses would do anything for a political. It is so gross and beneath the office.
I think that is clear. So now finally, we're going to go to Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Mika Brzezinski asked her not to make up excuses for what Trump clearly implied. Doesn't sound like she listened to her. Here she is.
Gillibrand owed an apology for the misunderstanding of the president's tweet this morning, because many, including Senator, think that it's about sexual innuendos.
I think only if your mind is in the gutter would you have read it that way. And so, no.
Sure, sure. This is the same excuse they use every single time. Trump says something outrageous and horrific, and then they go, well, golly gee, we didn't imply anything by it. Is that what you thought he meant? Oh, well, then the problem is with you. Tis. Please, you're embarrassing yourself. But you do it on a daily basis, because apparently, like the president, you have no shame at all. This guy's disgusting. Unfortunately, he's the president of the United States. I can't wait to see how we're going to get him out, because we need to. But to have him represent, look, we all live in this country. We got to deal with this guy every single day. Our daughters have to listen to this crap every single day. All the women in the country have to put up with this crap every single day. Get him out. Godspeed to Robert Mueller.
Baruch atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch Atta Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Shalom, salam aleikum. You can see Christian, Jews and Muslims living together and praying, amen. Let's give thanks and praises. Baruch atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch Atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Jerusalem, here I am. Jerusalem, je t'aime. Jerusalem, here I am. Jerusalem, je t'aime. Thank you. פיראטי. ישראל היקירתי, אני אוהב אותך. ישראל היקירתי, ישראל היקירתי, Israel.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Mattei. President Trump has formally announced his decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the American embassy there.
I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering. I've judged this course of action to be in the best interests of the United States of America and the pursuit of peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Protests have already begun in the occupied territories where Palestinian factions have declared 3 days of rage. Well, to discuss this, I spoke earlier to Rami Khoury, Senior Public Policy Fellow and Professor of Journalism at American University of Beirut, also a non-resident Senior Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School. I began by asking Rami Khoury his response to Trump's announcement.
I think President Trump showed that he is engaging in dangerous, reckless behavior, which he's been doing all along in his last 10, 11 months in office. But he's dealing in a level of incoherence and recklessness now that is really unprecedented, because he's taking a position which the entire world, virtually the entire world, rejects. Not just Arabs are angry and Palestinians, the whole world. And there's United Nations resolutions on the status of Jerusalem, and he's just thrown this out the window. So we're dealing with a level of intellectual and political arrogance by the American president that is really dangerous for the region and I think for the United States, because what this does is it puts the United States in a position where it is the only country on a serious level in the world that is going against established international law and UN resolutions on the status of Jerusalem. And it's essentially sending the message that don't worry about international law and conventions and treaties and UN Council resolutions. You can ignore all that stuff. Do what you want. So this is a recipe for the law of the jungle. And it further hurts the United States, because it basically is sending the message that you can't trust the United States to keep its word or to do the right thing. That the U.S. will do whatever it wants if it thinks it's good for its own domestic political purposes or to raise campaign funding from extremists in Las Vegas and other places in the United States. That's the message that the world gets. It's just, it's a combination of political and moral corruption and criminality, which is frightening because it's done out of the White House. This is totally un-American, totally unprecedented, and very dangerous.
But in terms of this being un-American and unprecedented, it's true that this is a formal decision that carries some huge symbolic weight for the U.S. to do this, but how much is it an actual departure from existing U.S. policy, in the sense that the U.S. has supported Israel's de facto annexation of East Jerusalem by continuing to provide billions of dollars in aid and also providing plenty of diplomatic cover at the U.N. when other countries tried to hold Israel to account for its takeover of East Jerusalem?
Well, those are important points that you make. And it is really at the symbolic level that this is important. But this is symbolism that is more important than anything that's done at the practical level, because it's the last arena where Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, and even many Jews of good conscience hold out the hope that there can be a negotiated peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is fair to Israelis and to Palestinians. And this was the last thread linking the condition of the peace negotiations, which have been moribund for 20 years under American tutelage. But this was the last thread that possibly gave people some hope that maybe a two-state solution could be negotiated, because everything else that Israel wants, the extremist right-wing government under Netanyahu wants, settlements, militarism, siege of Gaza, putting thousands of people in jail, expropriating land, bombing and killing people at will, arresting people, torturing people, everything that Israel has done, the United States has, as you said, has either acquiesced in or explicitly supported. But this was the last thread of decency, legality, and good conscience behavior. And the United States just threw it in the garbage can.
Can you talk about the Saudi context here? Because one other thing that makes this different from previous U.S.-Israeli policies towards Palestinians is now Israel appears to have the open cooperation of the Saudi government.
One of the big issues that's going to become clear in the next couple of weeks or couple of months, if this continues, is that you will see a big gap emerging in some Arab countries between the leaderships and the people, between the government and the citizens. Because the Arab governments historically have done whatever they need to do, like most governments in the world do, like Trump is doing now. He'll do anything that they need to do to get support politically to stay in power. And Trump is doing this essentially for political support of pro-Israeli right-wing extremists, including evangelical Christian extremists and donors. And Arab governments are the same. They'll do anything that they feel is going to keep them in power. And they will try to figure out a way to be friends with Israel while the vast majority of their people are critical of Israel in the current situation of Palestinian-Israeli relations. The vast majority of Arabs have made it clear that they're willing to negotiate a permanent peaceful resolution of the conflict. But in the current situation of Israel continuing to annex and build settlements in Arab East Jerusalem, public opinion in the Arab world is extremely hostile to what Israel does. And if the Arab governments try to get closer to Israel, this is going to open a huge wedge between citizen and state. And we may find significant problems within Arab countries, not necessarily hostility against Israel or the U.S., which has been expressed before and has achieved virtually nothing. But you will find Arab citizens finally turning against their governments, saying, what in the world are you people doing? You can't make war. You can't make peace. You let us be humiliated. You've turned the Arab world into a trash heap of morality and dignity and legality. And this is the final indignity that the American president imposes on us, basically telling us that we, the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Muslims, the people of the Middle East, that we have no rights, we have no voice, we have no place in the world, that what we feel or what we think is our rights doesn't count. And the U.S. can do anything it wants, even on the most sacred, sensitive, important political issue in our universe, which is Jerusalem. And the Arab leaders are going to be told, if you can't do anything about this, then maybe you shouldn't be there. So we don't know how it's going to play out. But clearly, this is an issue where leaders and citizens in the Arab world have very different perspectives.
Rami Khoury, Senior Public Policy Fellow and Professor of Journalism at American University of Beirut, also a non-resident Senior Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School. Thank you.
You bet.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
Would do anything for campaign contributions. Many, many people see this as a sexual innuendo. What is the president suggesting?
I think that the president is very obvious. This is the same sentiment that the president has expressed many times before when he has exposed the corruption of the entire political system. In fact, he's used similar terminology many times when talking about politicians of both parties, both men and women, and certainly in his campaign to drain the swamp. The system is clearly broken. It's clearly rigged for special interest. And this president is someone that can't be bought. And it's one of the reasons that he's president today.
So you're saying that this quote, Senator Gillibrand would do anything, is a reference to campaign contributions in Washington, the swamp. This has nothing to do with her being a female What is he alleging would happen behind closed doors with her?
He's not alleging anything. He's talking about the way that our system functions as it is, that politicians repeatedly beg for money. That's not something new. And that comment, frankly, isn't something new. If you look back at past comments that this president has made, he's used that same terminology many times in reference to men. There's no way that this is sexist at all. This is simply talking about a system that we have that is broken, in which special interests control our government. And I don't think that there's probably many people that are more controlled by political contributions than the senator that the president referenced. Steve?
Does the president want Roy Moore to be seated in the Senate if he wins tonight? And does he plan to call it tonight?
In terms of calls, I'm not aware that anything is scheduled, win or lose. In terms of being seated, I can't speak on a hypothetical, certainly not one that could potentially influence an election one way or the other due to the Hatch Act. John?
Sarah, does the president agree with his outside legal counsel that a special prosecutor should be appointed to look into the goings-on at the Department of Justice during the election campaign in 2016, since the revelation about Bruce Orr, the former associate deputy attorney general?
I think it's something that certainly causes a lot of concern, not just for the president and the administration, but I think probably for all Americans, and something that if we're going to continue to investigate things, let's look at something where there's some real evidence and some real proof of wrongdoing, and this looks pretty bad, and I think it's something we should certainly look at.
So,
Dave?
So would he support the appointment of a special prosecutor to look into this?
I haven't asked him that directly, but I know that he has great concern about some of the conduct that's taken place, and something that we certainly would like to see looked at. Dave?
Thanks, Sarah. Congressional leaders are saying that they have no plans to reimpose sanctions on Iran by the deadline tomorrow that the president initiated back in October when he decertified Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. Is the White House okay with this? No action? And if so, where are the teeth in the president's move to decertify them from compliance?
Well, look, the administration continues to make encouraging progress with Congress to fix the U.S.-Iran deal and address long-term proliferation issues. There was actually no deadline to act by this week, as the administration did not ask that Congress introduce legislation to reimpose JCPOA-related sanctions. Jordan?
Thanks, Sarah. Senator Grassley said that he's advised the White House to reconsider the nomination of Jeff Mattier to the federal court in Texas and Brett Talley in Alabama. Has the president spoken Senator Grassley about his concerns, and does the president plan to pull back those nominations?
I'm not sure if they've spoken directly. I'll have to check and circle back with you. Matthew?
Thanks, Sarah. Bashar al-Assad and Rodrigo Duterte both recently have used the phrase fake news to dismiss damaging reports about their regimes, and a state official in Myanmar recently said that the Muslim minority Rohingya don't exist and added it's fake news. Is the White House concerned at all about authoritarian regimes adopting this phrase, fake news, to try to delegitimize the press? And does President Trump bear any responsibility for the popularization of this phrase among some world leaders?
I think the White House is concerned about false and inaccurate information being pushed out and to mislead the American people. I think I made that clear yesterday. In terms of other leaders, I'd have to look at their comments to be more specific on what they've said. But our concern is making sure that the information that the people receive in this country is fair and accurate. And when it isn't, that it's corrected and corrected in the same fashion in which it was first presented when it was wrong, which is very rarely the case. Kristen?
The term fake news, that doesn't. Sir? When you hear autocrats using the term fake news to describe events that reflect poorly on their regimes, that doesn't cause concern here?
Look, I'm not going to speak to specifics of another country when I don't know the details. What I can talk about are the problems that we have in this country with inaccuracies that happen frequently within news stories. And so that I feel comfortable speaking about. Without that information and that detail in front of me, I don't want to weigh in too deeply. Kristen?
Sarah, thank you. The president tweeted today that the accusations against him are false, fabricated stories of women who I don't know and or have never met, fake news. And yet the reality is he's pictured with a number of the women who have accused him of the misconduct. So do you concede that that part of his statement is not true?
The president was referencing the three individuals that were part of a press conference yesterday. And simply stating that you don't know someone means that you don't have a relationship with them.
Correct.
He's referencing the three from yesterday.
And Sarah, members of Congress have called for an investigation into these accusations. If President Trump is confident that they are not true, would he support such an investigation?
Look, the President has answered these questions. He has spoken to these accusations and denied and pushed that they are all false and fabricated accusations. Frankly, I think if Congress wants to spend time investigating things, they should probably focus on some of the things that the American people would really like them to investigate, like how to secure our borders, how to defeat ISIS, how to pass tax reform that actually impacts them. If you look at the issues and poll after poll after poll taken by a number of the outlets in this room and pushed out regularly, the issues that are top mind number one every single time, the economy, jobs, national security, immigration, health care, yet we never talk about those issues. In fact, 90% of the coverage that is happened, hold on, I'll let you finish. I'm going to finish this statement. 90% of the coverage that comes out of the media is negative and rarely covers those topics. And those are the things that the American people want to talk about. If Congress wants to investigate something, I think that they should look at some of the priorities of the people that they actually represent.
Disgusting businesses all across the country. There have been a number of people who've been fired over this. So why not allow this congressional investigation to go forward, and the president, if he's confident in the accusations being
false? The president has addressed these concerns. He's addressed them directly. You guys spent months talking about them on the campaign trail, and the American people voted for this president. They have confidence in this president, and they wanted him to lead our country, and they wanted him to focus on things like the economy, focus on health care, focus on fixing our broken tax system, focus on fixing our borders, and focus on national security. That's what we're here to do. That's what we're focused on. These questions have been asked and answered, and we're ready to move forward and focus on the questions of the day that the American people have. April?
Gillibrand owed an apology for the misunderstanding from the president's tweet this morning, because many, including the senator, thinks that it's about sexual innuendos.
I think only if your mind is in the gutter would you have read it that way. And so, no. Hunter?
No, it's not. When he went to say, what he said was open, and it was not mined in the
He's
butt.
Obviously talking about political partisan games that people often play, and the broken system that he's talked about repeatedly. This isn't new. This isn't a new sentiment. This isn't new terminology. He's used it several times before. As I said a few minutes ago, he's used it several times before, referencing men of both both parties, in fact. And so I think that there, if you look back at the past comments he's made, it was very clear what his reference was. Hunter?
Thank you, Sarah. So looking at this issue with the system, the president gave almost $8,000 to Senator Gillibrand over the years. His daughter also gave her $2,000. What specifically did they get for these contributions if she was offering?
Look, I think oftentimes what you do, you're getting access. A member of Congress will take your phone call. They'll take your meeting. And if you're driving something as a businessman that the president may or may not have been driving at any particular point, you can talk to that individual about it. And sometimes they carry your water. That's the reason that we have a broken system. That's a reason that often special interests control our government more than the people do. And that's one of the reasons that this president ran to be president. And it's one of the top reasons I think that he won and that he's sitting in the Oval Office today and Hillary Clinton's not, because he couldn't be bought, and everybody knew that she could, because they'd seen it time and time again.
Is he admitting that he bought access in a corrupt way?
Look, I think he is admitting that he's participating in a rigged system. He said that on the campaign trail. He knows how the system works. I think it would be disingenuous for anybody not to understand that, but at least this president is being honest about the process and his willingness to actually fix it and drain the swamp. Mara?
So, Kirsten Gillibrand called for him to resign, and he says over and over again that he's a counterfeiter. So the next day after she does that, he wakes up and you're saying that he's tweeting about the campaign finance system.
I'm talking about the fact that she's controlled by special interest. I'm talking about the fact she's a wholly owned subsidiary of people that donate to her campaign. She's a puppet for Chuck Schumer. I'm talking about a number of issues that she has, none of which make her an independent individual, but more somebody that is controlled by people that help donate money to her cause. That's simply all I'm stating.
What finance reform does the president want?
Look, the president's been talking about the need for us to put a stronger ban on lobbyists participating in the government process. We've taken a stronger ethics pledge under this administration than previous administrations. I think those are some of the first steps and something that we're going to continue working on over the next 7 years. John?
You're familiar with the president's tweets. He tweets pretty often. In this particular,
I've noticed that.
Yeah, a little bit. In this particular case, his criticism of Senator Gillibrand was very personal. Why must he criticize in such personal terms? He called a sitting elected U.S. senator a lightweight. Why go after her in such personal? Such a personal matter.
I don't think that's all that personal. I mean, if you want to talk about personal, look at the comments that she's made about this president over the last several months. Look, the president is always going to be somebody who responds. We've said that many times before, and he's simply talking about a system that doesn't work for the citizens of this country, and he wants to fix it. Trey?
Thanks, Jared. Two quick questions for you. One following up on John's question from earlier about a second special counsel. Does the president have confidence in the FBI as it exists today?
Look, the president has confidence in Director Wray and his ability to clean up some of the mess left behind by his predecessor. I know I've addressed that before, and he certainly has confidence in the rank and file members of the FBI.
Follow-up on foreign policy. Today, Bloomberg has an article out about the Trump administration encouraging Saudi Arabia to consider bids from U.S. companies as it relates to building nuclear reactors. Does the president see this as an opportunity to bring up human rights in Yemen during these talks with Saudi Arabia?
I'm not aware of those specific conversations in this process, so I would have to ask and certainly get back to you. Take one last question, Margaret.
Thank you. Adrian McMaster gave some really interesting remarks at a luncheon earlier today, and he spoke in really strong terms about China and Russia. He said they were undermining the international order and stability and ignoring the sovereign rights of their neighbors and the rule of law. He went on to talk about Russia in particular. He didn't use the words election meddling, but he talked about subversion, disinformation, propaganda, and basically pitting people against each other to try to create crises of confidence. So what I wanted to know is, does the president agree with all of General McMaster's statements, and is that a foreshadowing of a national security strategy that will take a harder tack on Russia and China than the administration has so far?
Okay, I think we've been very hard on Russia from the beginning. There have been sanctions. We've increased energy exportation from this country, and we've done things to put pressure on Russia, asking them to engage in a bigger and greater way on some of the common enemies that we face. In terms of like a rundown, I haven't had a chance to sit down with the president and go detail by detail, but General McMaster certainly is someone who understands and knows the president's feelings and our relationships with foreign partners, and something that we certainly feel confident in him speaking about. Thanks so much, guys.
Could we please get the president out here for a final podium? Could we please see the president out?
Capitalism and chaos. As the first year begins to end for the Trump presidency, we see the emergence more of chaos than triumph. To be sure, a rather loathsome tax bill passed that transfers more wealth to the super rich. But internationally, we see governments less stable, not more so. For example, in England, the Brexit poll has led to increasing economic instability and a measurable fall in wages for British workers. And there, as any other place in the world, economic instability is but the precursor to political instability. Speaking of instability, look at the U.S. The U.S. is governed by a nut surrounded by nuts. But there is a method to this madness. The writer Naomi Klein has written about what can be called disaster capitalism, or how economic elites profit from social dysfunction. She writes about how imperial capital looted Argentina, South Africa, and other states to impose the system of neoliberalism. But what happens abroad inevitably creeps home. The mass wealth transfers taking place these days under the rubric of tax cuts is setting a similar stage here. Marr said the state is but the executive committee for the ruling class. Who can argue that legislators don't serve the interests of a rich and a super rich? You vote for them, but they don't vote for you. Their interests are not your interests. They never are. They never were. Capitalism is the unbridled, unprincipled drive to wealth acquisition. The means to that end are irrelevant. In Prison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me? Bad times are coming and I reap what I done sow. Hey, hey. Well, let me tell you something.
Network. I'm Jessel Noor. We are joined today live in studio by Chokwe Antar Lumumba, attorney, activist, and current mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
Yeah. So you are 5 months into your mayorship. You've promised to make Jackson, Mississippi, the world's most radical city. Mm-hmm. I wanted to start off with some topical news before we get into your platform and your agenda and your accomplishments and the challenges you've faced thus far. It's been reported Donald Trump will visit Jackson this weekend to visit the opening of the new Civil Rights Museum that is opening in Jackson, in Mississippi, one of the battlegrounds of the Civil Rights Movement. What's your response to this? And if he does visit, what do you hope he learns about the history of the Civil Rights Movement?
So the opening of the Civil Rights Movement, Civil Rights Museum, is a long-awaited event for many citizens of Jackson and people throughout the state. I think it's an important recognition of struggle. It's an important recognition of you know, such a heinous history and people's resilience to come out of that, right? But I believe any recognition or any celebration of struggle must consider what the next steps forward are, right? And so though it is important to recognize history, it is important that we make certain that we are moving forward, not to repeat the mistakes of the past, and to continue to progress our society. So I'm more interested in Donald Trump's commitment to moving away from this erosion of human rights that he seems committed to, right? And less concerned about whether he gives a pacifying visit to Mississippi in order to show some appreciation for our Civil Rights Museum. And so that's more important to me.
And it's said that it might be more tied into wanting to get close to Roy Moore ahead of the election next week. And so that is ultimately what might be his motivation. But I want to start on a national level. Trump's policies have been, his agenda has been an attack on working people, immigrants, dismantling and attacking Obamacare, other policies that are part of the social safety net that provide comfort and support and basic dignity to people of this country. Mm-hmm. You're trying to implement a radical progressive agenda in Jackson, put forward self-determination and have and help build an economy that's not built on exploitation. Talk about what the impacts of federal policy have been and how they've impacted your work so far. You're just 5 months into office, but mm-hmm. talk about what those impacts have been.
Well, since we're on a discussion about the federal government and also it's tied into a discussion about Trump, in answering that question, I'll share what some of the questions that have been posed to me recently. People have asked, in Mississippi, how did you feel after Trump was elected president? And what I share with people is the Wednesday after Trump became president, I woke up in Mississippi, right? And that means that no matter whether Trump is president, whether it was Obama, Clinton, or Bush, Mississippi has always been at the bottom. And so it is apparent to me that what it's going to require to change conditions for people in Mississippi, for people in Jackson, Mississippi specifically, is developing a strategy and a plan that we can execute, looking at how we can create conditions which are more self-determined. And so that's ultimately what I mean by being the most radical city on the planet, is giving people more access. In fact, confronting our electoral politics system and trying to revolutionize that, right? Giving people more voice. And so we think that is necessary. That is an important part of how you really change conditions for people. And so we do this through the invent or the movement of people's assemblies that allow people to speak to their conditions. And so that is very important to us.
And talk more about the People's Assembly, because people want to know more about this around the country and here in Baltimore. And these are forums where, if not you, other people from your administration listen directly to their constituents and get to hear their demands and then break up into working groups and sort of hash out how to possibly implement these plan. Can you go into
that? Yeah, I'll speak to that. So I believe in a process called unity, debate, unity. I believe that we can all come in a room and establish where we see eye to eye, We can debate where we may have differences with the objective of reaching greater unity at the end of the day than we walked in the room with, right? And in that process, you have to open yourself up to critique. You have to open up yourself to varied perspectives of any particular issue that we're looking at. And so these community gatherings, these people's assemblies, are an opportunity for our administration to provide information to the citizens regarding, you know, hot ticket or big ticket items that are coming before the city. It is also an opportunity for the leadership to receive information from the community, what they see on the grassroots level, what they're experiencing, what they feel is working and not working. It is not meant to be a vehicle or to be a an instrument of the administration. It is meant to be its own separate pressure mechanism by itself. And it should operate regardless of who is in office, giving people more voice, giving people an opportunity to weigh into the process. It's been said that 3 minutes on a microphone during a city council meeting or what have you does not make community participation. And so we're moving into other models. We're moving into participatory budgeting. These are the ideas that we want to push forward and become a model for the rest of the world. I didn't say this earlier when you asked the question about Trump. And you talked about, our push to be the most radical city on the planet. I think I need to speak to that, because what that means is not that we're reckless in our pursuits, but rather intentional in the way we engage people, intentional in the way we involve people in the process. We have to challenge the fear of the word radical. Right. A radical is a person who seeks change. A radical is a person who looks at a condition and fights to build better. And so the reality is, if we see a need for change within our communities, then we need to be prepared to be as radical as the circumstances dictate we should be. And so we're implementing ideas and concepts such as people's assemblies in order to do so. As much information, as much involvement, as much engagement as we can get from the people, the better. We don't believe that any one person or any one administration has all of the ideas, but we believe in collective genius.
And I want to remind our viewers, we are live, so please send us your questions and your comments, and we will try to get to them all. I wanted to turn to how this mission is to be implemented, because we know in cities like Jackson, revenue has been cut steadily for decades now. Much of it is controlled by the state. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the problem we have here in Baltimore. And something that came up in a recent talk you gave is that wealth is being made in cities like Jackson and Baltimore, but it's leaving at 5 o'clock because so much revenue comes from property taxes, and that's how you fund schools and other services. And the workers might be working in your city, but they're not living there. How do you sort of change that paradigm? How do you get that money to stay in Jackson?
Yeah. So, around the country, there are discussions about how do you go about economic development? How do you pursue either businesses or entities that bring the promise or the idea of new opportunities for the citizens of that particular city? I think there's something to be said about a business-friendly environment. An environment that can stimulate the economy of that city. But then there also has to be the consideration of, not just how businesses are profitable, but how businesses invest back in your community. And I think that is a conversation that we often fall short in terms of having. We in Jackson, we want businesses to come. We want them to be successful. We want them to make a lot of money, but we want them to invest back in our citizens. And so what we're seeing are, opportunities where people are employed in Jackson, but, there are very few retail opportunities. There are very few opportunities to retain the dollars that benefit, the tax dollars that benefit the citizens of our city. And so what we believe is that, though we want to position ourselves as being business friendly, we also want to demonstrate an ability to fill the voids of our community for ourselves. An example of that would be, as I've mentioned on several occasions, Jackson, a city of a little less than 180,000 people, does not have a movie theater within its city limits. And they're in the bedroom communities around Jackson. And so what we're looking at is how we can invest into cooperative business models that can fill voids so that we can build for ourselves and use that as a mechanism to leverage other investment opportunities. And then we're trying to maintain a strong stated goal of participation within our city on contracts from the city. What we're our ultimate goal, and I'm not suggesting that we're there or anywhere close to there presently, but our stated goal is to have 50% of the subcontracting being minority subcontracting and 60% of the boots on ground being Jacksonians. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's not a race issue, right? It's an economics issue. Mm-hmm. If 85% of your population is left-handed, you need some left-handed jobs.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what about some alternative revenue streams? What about a something like a tax for people that work in the city but don't live there,
mm-hmm.
A toll or mm-hmm. A tax on businesses that don't employ? Or are you going to have mandates that force employers to hire local or contractors to hire local? What is the processes involved in that? How much power do you have to establish that?
So that is the question, is the amount of power that we actually have to enforce those things. Toll roads, commuter taxes, all of those things are initiatives that have to be initiated by the state. The state legislature, in Mississippi at least, has to agree to those measures. And in large extent, the majority of the representation of the state legislature, that is not something that they find favorable. And so though we will push forward those initiatives because we feel that those are beneficial to the citizens of Jackson, you just spoke about the dynamic, which I spoke to in that discussion about money leaving the city at 6 o'clock. So we're going to push those measures forward. However, I am a firm believer if your strategy is dependent upon someone else to act on your behalf, you don't have a strategy. You have a wish list. Right. And so much of what I speak to isn't ignoring those measures. It isn't ignoring those as opportunities. But it's considering what can we do? What can we begin to do or to implement to rescue ourselves? And so that's what we want is more self-determination, more control over our destinies. And the more we depend on someone else to act, it's actually operating in a reverse fashion than truly being self-determined.
So we're getting some questions in from Facebook and from YouTube. People want to know how this can tie into a green economy. We know that climate change is the greatest threat that humans have inflicted upon themselves, mm-hmm. In the history of this planet. Something that on a federal level, the Trump administration is climate deniers in power. We're withdrawing from international treaties dealing with reducing emissions. How much of this progress needs and should be made on a local level in mm-hmm. cities like Jackson?
Well, I think that, we'll never really have a true green movement until it is implemented on the local level. And we begin to buy into the importance of it on a local level and also understand the trends not only around this country but around the world that see green industry being one of the rising industries that create opportunities for jobs. And so we need to not only invite these industries into our city, we need to be the creators, the developers of those. And so that not only, the conversation about how we become more sustainable cities, but that also ties into the economics question that you spoke to. No longer just looking at how you develop as a matter of solicitation, as a matter of soliciting these industries or these businesses here, but how you support and nurture the development of them from within. What we're seeking to do is create an incubator fund that looks at creating space and opportunity for new businesses to start up, and we would like for many of those businesses to be green businesses as well.
Cooperatives, worker-run businesses are something foreign sounding to a lot of Americans, but they're well established in Latin America and Europe and much of the rest of the world. You've made that a key point in your platform. There's other organizations doing that similar work in Jackson itself.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about why you think cooperatives could be the answer to some of these problems and questions as well.
Well, Well, and I'm glad that you raise that question and that point. First and foremost, if we look at, you know, trends not only in Latin America, but in the United States and other spaces in the world, we see that people are identifying the benefits of them. Land O'Lakes Butter is a cooperative. Florida Orange Growers is a cooperative. Ace Hardware is a cooperative. The largest cooperative business, or one of the largest cooperative businesses that I can consider today, is the Green Bay Packers, right? Mm-hmm. Green Bay Packers, the city of Green Bay, which is actually smaller than the city of Jackson, has found a way to own its own professional football team. And so I always...
Very successful.
Yeah, very successful. I'm a Lions fan, so that's hard for me to admit, but it's true. But, I joke often that I'm of the mind if Green Bay can figure out how to own its own professional football team, then Jackson can figure out how to own its own movie theater. And so what cooperative businesses, which are not a new notion, that's something that goes back to the days of Fannie Lou Hamer, who looked at organizing farmers in Mississippi. What a cooperative business does, its very mission is to serve the community that it's in. And so we can talk about small businesses. We can talk about predominantly black communities, black businesses. And those are important things to support and to raise up. But we have to recognize the limitations even within those models. A black business, for instance, is like any other business, which looks to exploit its market. It looks to return as much profit as it can. And if it has exhausted the market in which it's in, then it may actually leave the community which gave birth to it and go to another community in order to get higher returns. And so it's no loyalty, right, to the community that gave rise to it. A cooperative business, a worker-owned business, a community-owned business, by its very nature, is built or created to support the community in which it resides. And so we see that as an opportunity by which we can not only fill gaps, fill voids in terms of economic development opportunities in our city. Those businesses, as they do well, as they increase, we don't have to fear that they will pick up their bags and leave. There are countless businesses over the last decade or so in Jackson that have done very well, that have left not because their profits were declining, but because they simply had no loyalty to the citizens which they served, and they felt that they could still take advantage of that consumer base moving up the road and not ultimately profiting the citizens that shop there on a consistent basis.
There's been a lot made about this second Amazon headquarters. Mm-hmm. Cities have been falling over themselves, trying to give the best deal, in some cases offering essentially control of tax dollars and functions of city government, handing it over to Amazon. Did Jackson make an application to Amazon? And what's your view on subsidizing corporations with the promise of jobs and investment coming in return?
So Amazon put out a very strict criteria of the things that they were looking for from cities. And Jackson, quite honestly, just did not meet that criteria. Mm-hmm. Though Jackson, like many other cities, I can't sit here and tell you that I wouldn't, be happy about an Amazon coming to Jackson. But I think that our focus must really center more not on the second home of Amazon, but the first home of the very next Amazon, right? How do we build businesses? How do we create that incubator fund that supports the small tech groups or the marketplace of ideas? We have Jackson is a college town. We have 40,000 college students. So we need to be supporting the next young person that presents the idea that grows into an Amazon. And I think cities, honestly, can do more to control or be better positioned if that was the approach that they took, as opposed to auctioning off the entire storehouse in order to get what appears to be a great benefit. I think that it can be beneficial, but you can place yourself in such a compromised, put yourself in such a compromised position that it ultimately, it leads to questions as to whether it is actually in the best interest of the citizens you serve.
We have a question from Iceland.
A
viewer from Iceland. Mm-hmm. What cities internationally do you look for inspiration in your work in Jackson?
Well, I will say that I've had the opportunity to visit a few spaces. What comes to mind right now, I know that there has been some political strife as of late. But as I talked about these cooperative businesses, I had the opportunity to go to Barcelona and meet with the vice mayor of Barcelona. We looked at the Fab Lab initiative that is taking place not only in Barcelona, but around the world, the cooperative business models. And I think, you know, identifying or you know, recognizing the technological advances that the world is taking today is important. As we look at the Fab Lab initiative, what we're seeing is that people are able to produce manufacture goods at a much more grassroots level. And so instead of becoming a victim to our advances, like we saw with the auto industry, we need to take advantage of how we return this ability to be a benefit to the citizens, a benefit to the communities that have not had these resources available to them historically. And so that's important. You know, when I look at fabrication technology, which is enabling people to create everything from vehicles to homes, to furniture. We need to put that type of technology in the hands of our young people and see what they can produce and teach them to control that and to command spaces that use it for their benefit.
You talk a lot about education in your campaign. That's one of your goals in office is to help improve the education system in Jackson. The state wanted to take over the city of Jackson's public education system, public mm-hmm. schools. Talk about where that fight sits mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. and what your vision is for a stronger K-12 public education system. We know that in cities like Jackson and Baltimore, predominantly black schools have been historically underfunded,
yes.
and you're competing against, you know, as far as test scores go, against suburbs that don't have the same challenges and a lack of funding that you face.
There is a direct connection between resources and the success of school districts. And so we need to look at the appropriate allocation of resources to our public school system. As spoke to, Jackson was under the threat of a state takeover. And to some extent, that effort is still being waged. What took place is that the state school board issued a state of emergency for the Jackson Public School District, which then led to an order being placed on the governor's desk in order to sign, in order to declare a state of emergency over Jackson Public School District, which would have led to a conservator being placed over the district. What we did was we met with the governor. And to be fair and to be completely frank, it was a positive conversation, right? And what we did was we looked towards operational unity. And what that means is instead of discussing our differences, we talked about our common ends and how they were affected by the decision that was put before him. And in that conversation, what the governor shared is that he wished he had a third option. And so we left that discussion with my team, with a number of community organizers. We considered what a third option looked like, and what we created was essentially an advisory commission. Our proposal called it an educational excellence advisory commission, which ultimately has become is a makeup of 15 individuals. We signed an MOU. That kept the school district under local control. The MOU is between the governor, myself, and the Kellogg Foundation. And this commission does not replace our school board. We still were able to maintain our school board selections. They do not make decisions with regard to contracts. They do not make hiring decisions, but what they do is they evaluate the conditions of JPS and what the needs of JPS are. The Kellogg Foundation agreed to fund intentional community discussions where the community could weigh in terms of their aspirations and goals for our public school system. And then the commission will select. The primary goal of the commission is to select a third-party evaluator that could evaluate based on the community's stated goals and aspirations, do a gap analysis of where JPS is today versus where the community would like to see JPS. And Kellogg will fund those changes that we see fit.
And this is a question from a viewer. We know it's harder for majority black school districts to get equitable funding and resources compared to majority white school districts. Do you think a separate but equal K through 12 education system will remain the future if housing and education policies, along with the courts, continue to allow segregation to prevail? Mm-hmm. Efforts to integrate schools in Jackson, there's been a long struggle for that, and they have not led to a better and more equitable allocation of resources.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have to fight back any efforts to rob the public coffers, which take away from the needs of public education. We have seen segregation. You know, if you follow and track the history of the preparatory schools in Jackson, Mississippi, they were founded, you know, as, you know, integration took place, right? As the school system, as the public school system was integrated, that's when they were founded. And so now...
So these are alternatives to the public school
system.
These
are alternatives. Yeah. And so I'll tell you, for instance, when I was in high school, I graduated high school in 2001. My high school was 100% African-American. It was 100% black. You know, when people are looking to disinvest in public education, it's because they don't see, the investment doesn't appear to be, it doesn't affect them. It doesn't affect their children. They don't see that. And so they'd rather rob the public coffers to provide funding so that they no longer have to fit the bill for the private education that they choose. And you know, in doing so, it may help a handful of children, but it will never make the tremendous impact that is needed within our public school system. There are some things that we honestly have to confront ourselves. For instance, in Jackson, you know, we have a school district where the number of facilities that we have were built at a time where the population was higher, right? We don't have that population within our city, nor does that population exist within our student enrollment. And so we have to visit the possibility of closing some of these facilities. Now, in doing so, we need to look for alternative uses for these buildings before we close them so that it continues to serve the community. I've talked about ideas like teen centers, spaces where young people can come. They can pursue their interests, whether it be athletics, whether it be music, whether it be art. And it's a safe space that they could utilize while they're not in school. And that not only helps nurture their development in terms of their academic advancement, but it helps nurture them in terms of steering them towards more positive activities than some of the detrimental things that young people may find themselves confronted with in hours where they're the most vulnerable.
And it's a similar problem to what Baltimore is facing. It's a school system that was built for far more students than currently enrolled. So now mm-hmm. they're going through that painful process of closing schools. And, you know, I documented that same fight in New York where a number of schools were closed, and in Chicago and in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Is there going to have to be a balance between the needs of those communities and the attachment to those schools, those neighborhood schools, and the need to accommodate a different size yeah. school population?
And there will be. But I think that is why the community involvement piece, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm only speaking from the frame of Jackson because mm-hmm. that's what I know best. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to Baltimore and, you know, I may have some familiarity with other spaces around the country. But what we see in Jackson, it's important that as we create this MOU or this agreement, that the community be at the heart of it. And that's why, you know, the most important part of that that third option that we created is the community involvement piece, where the community can look at the needs of the district, where they can identify that you know, there are critical decisions that have to be made, where they can see the state of the district in terms of funding, and how we better allocate our resources to provide the very best to our students. And so I think that we find ourselves at odds when we fail. This returns to my initial point of giving people more access to their governance. We find ourselves at odds when we feel that we're making decisions in the best interest of people, as opposed to having people a part of the decisions that you know, are so impactful on their lives. You know, I'm a recovering attorney, right? I still hold my bar license, but, you know, I've put my practice aside. But as an attorney, what I and other attorneys do is we listen to expert advice. We listen to doctors, architects, and lawyers, other lawyers, in order to direct the course we go in any case. Well, being a mayor is much the same, where we have to listen to many of these experts. And I believe that the citizens of our city, the people, may or may not be experts in things like education, infrastructure, crime, and economic development. But what they all are experts in are the conditions in which they live. They know what makes things difficult for them. They know where they've seen trouble. They know what, you know, what makes their life more difficult, and what makes the quality of their life more difficult. And so we look for opportunities to engage and get feedback, understanding that there's always an opportunity to learn.
So we have questions flowing in from our viewers. I wanted to ask you about the state of Mississippi. It has the largest proportion of African Americans in the entire country, some 40%, 37
estimated 40%
yeah. or so. It's solidly red right now, but mm-hmm. I was looking at the numbers from the 2016 election. Just over half of voters that the voters that could have voted, you know, the voters of age, mm-hmm. Over 18 population mm-hmm. of citizens, voted in that election. Mm-hmm. So about 1 million people didn't vote, and I don't know the numbers, how many of those were disenfranchised because of yeah. convictions, but you know, Trump beat Hillary Clinton by just over 200,000 votes. Mm-hmm. So that million is still within that margin, well within that margin of victory.
Yeah.
Do you think that do you think it's possible to have a progressive takeover of the state? Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about how many of the policies are your hands are tied when talking about revenue and perhaps the school system and other you know, many other aspects of your governance. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's in the works and it's possible even in a deep, deep red state like Mississippi?
I think that it's more attainable than we give it credit for being. You know what, you know, as I started our discussion early on in saying that, you know, the Wednesday after Trump became president, I woke up in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of being tied into our partisan loyalties, you know, I think that we have to get to a place where we put people over politics. And, you know, whether or not you're a strong Democrat or a strong Republican, in a place like Mississippi, how well has it served you, mm-hmm. right? When Obama was president, you know, if you were poor in Mississippi before Obama, the likelihood you were poor after Obama, right? And that's not to say anything against him, right? If you were poor in Mississippi before Reagan, then you were poor after Reagan, right? And so we need to, you know, I think that Mississippi is a space where there's opportunity to develop. And you know, when Mississippi can be supported, and it's no longer the last in everything, right? And I think that you know, the parties have taken that for granted. You have
and you're talking about poverty rates, health indicators, there's a whole slew of
all those things. You know, HIV rate. I mean, you know, almost it's been you know, a space where people have dealt with a system of humiliation.
This is Wake Up Call on Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and we continue with the conversation with attorney and activist Chokwe Antar Lumumba, who is the current mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.